As the forecasted hyperactive Atlantic hurricane season unfolds, GeoTrack is pushing ahead full force to give you perspectives that help you prepare for flooding and damaging winds. Hey, GeoTrackers, this is Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrack podcast. Episode 99 of the podcast features an interview with Dr. Brett Webb, professor of civil engineering at University of South Alabama. Don't let the engineering part scare you. Dr. Webb is very down to earth, and we touch on a wide range of topics in this episode, ranging from the importance of clear communication to public health issues and insights on data science. The GeoTrack podcast explores the world to tell stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We focus on the physical processes that generate such extremes, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of such disasters to reduce the loss of life and property. The cost of this podcast is free, but we would love if you subscribe to the GeoTrack podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Your subscription helps us mark professional progress, enabling us to expand our collaborations and ensuring many more podcast episodes in the future. Well, hey, without further introduction, welcome to GeoTrack Podcast number 99, Coastal Resiliency from an Engineering Perspective with Dr. Brett Webb. Brett, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrack Podcast.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Brett, you have such a passion for communication and perception of risk, especially in the coastal environment. Let's unpack that. I mean, why is this so important?
Well, I mean, hurricanes are one of the deadlier extreme weather events in the United States. And it's unfortunate because, you know, these are forecasted and in many cases, well forecasted events. So, you know, we know these extreme weather events are going to happen when they're going to happen, you know, within some, you know, small margin of error. And nowadays, a lot more accuracy in terms of where they're going to happen. But yet, you know, on average, about 50 people die every year from hurricanes alone. You know, thinking back to Hurricane Ian that impacted Southwest Florida, there were over 150 deaths. And really what was a very well forecasted, you know, looking at it in hindsight, event with very predictable impacts. So one of the things that I'm very passionate about, as you mentioned, is trying to find ways to better communicate risk to the public about their vulnerability and exposure to extreme weather events like hurricanes along the coast now and also into the future.
Brett, as we think about better communication of coastal hazards like storm surge and hurricane impacts, how is the public getting blindsided? I mean, what are some main ways that people are not thinking accurately about their risk?
You know, it's interesting that about 41 million people in the United States live in what we would consider to be like a regulatory floodplain. So something that is mapped and is known, but statistics from FEMA show that only about 60% of people actually, you know, are aware that they're living in a floodplain. So, you know, almost half of the people that are living in a floodplain don't know that they're there. So they don't know that that hazard exists. Whether or not they're vulnerable or exposed to direct hurricane hazards or not, that's the first thing, is understanding your risk and your context of where you are. Whether you live in a floodplain, whether you're going to be very exposed to high winds or storm surge or wave impacts, things like that. But I think one of the things that we learned during and after Hurricane Ian is that across the public, and also even some of our emergency managers, there's still a fundamental misunderstanding of the hurricane forecasts and the advisory forecasts and the uncertainty cone. And, you know, that really led to some unfortunate decisions and how evacuation procedures were or were not carried out for that storm in particular. So whether it's the public or, you know, people we entrust to actually manage our risk, you know, along the coast, I think there's still a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, the forecast itself, the forecast advisory graphics, what they truly mean in terms of your place-based risk, but then also the fundamental misunderstanding or lack of understanding about really where you live and what that means in terms of your vulnerability. A lot of people don't even know.
You mentioned roughly half the people in the floodplain don't even know they're there. And actually on the coast, a lot of those floodplains are storm surge floodplains. I've seen this again and again. People living in those really disaster-prone, high-risk areas, they're thinking of hurricanes as wind events. Or even I saw recently in a coastal flood, people said, oh, we're supposed to get flooding. When's the rain going to start? They're thinking they maybe move from inland to the coast, and they're thinking if it floods, it has to be from rain. The idea of a saltwater flood, a storm surge, for a lot of them that live in those zones, it completely blindsides them. They don't even really know what that is, right?
Yeah, and I think for people that live along the coast, maybe we find this surprising, but there's a large percentage of the population along the coast, like you mentioned, that has moved here from somewhere else. And, you know, if I grew up living in Omaha, Nebraska, for example, I don't know that I'd be following the news media very closely during hurricane season and would have ever seen images or videos of active storm surge happening during a hurricane event. Which, you know, now we have a lot of video of, you know, especially over the past decade or more. So maybe we shouldn't be surprised at their lack of awareness, but we still need to do a better job communicating, you know, those risks and those hazards to the public on a very regular basis. And, you know, I think a lot of our news media outlets along the coast do a very good job at this. You know, they kind of start reminding people in April and May that hurricane season is coming and it's time to get ready. But again, it's so many people get their news in very, what I would consider now to be non-traditional ways that not everybody's turning into the evening news anymore. So as a community of professionals, finding new ways and, you know, better ways to communicate these hazards and risks, you know, from a preparedness standpoint, but also from a decision-making standpoint of deciding where you actually want to live and understanding, you know, your place-based context of what that means in terms of your vulnerability or risk, I think is very important.
Brett, you mentioned Hurricane Ian, and I wanted to ask you something. You know, I've always thought if we can accurately forecast and communicate the risk to people, for example, how high will the storm surge be? That's enough. And I saw with Ian when I was on the ground afterwards, a lot of local residents said, we heard the forecast. It was accurate. We just didn't believe that Mother Nature could push 12 feet of salt water in our community. We've been here since the early 70s. We've never seen anything like that. It was almost more of a, we heard it. It reached us. We just didn't believe it. What can we do to inform people that what may be coming to your community is beyond what you've ever seen in your community? I mean, is there a way we could show them pictures and videos of other communities that got hit? I mean, how do we reach people with a message to say the hazard that may be coming to your community is unlike anything you've seen before?
Yeah, that awareness and that memory is a very real thing that I think all of us struggle with when we're talking to communities about their risk, especially when they haven't in their collective consciousness have ever experienced that type of event. You know, you'd have to go, you know, pretty far back into the early 20th century to find a hurricane that had even close to those types of impacts in Southwest Florida. But they were there and they were known by some, but, you know, communities in Southwest Florida are, you know, predominantly people that have moved in from other places. So they don't have that collective memory. They haven't been there, you know, for they don't have generations of knowledge and context about what has happened in the past. So to your point about, you know, not believing that it could happen. So receiving the message, hearing the message, understanding maybe even what it means, but then not following through on action for evacuation or preparation. You know, one of the things that I find challenging today is, you know, the concept of the public trusting the communicators. And so I think there's a lot of distrust about what we communicate to the public now. And that's a shame because, you know, we are, as scientists and engineers, we are, you know, one of the things that we are entrusted with is communicating accurate information to the public, especially on the engineering side for, you know, the safety and welfare of the public. And so we should be people that are entrusted with, you know, communicating accurate information in a timely fashion. But the public, sometimes still struggles with trusting what we're saying and believing that it could actually happen. So to your point about showing them pictures and videos, that that's going to be very important moving forward, especially, you know, when we have a forecasted event that's going to impact a community in a way that probably that community has not experienced those types of impacts or that level of damage in the past.
Yeah, just to kind of show this is what Mother Nature can do, right? And these high magnitude events like a big storm surge or a hurricane hit, they're so what we call low frequency, right? They don't happen very often. And in any given community, like you said, the collective knowledge may not be there that people remember that happening. But if you go back 50, 100, 140 years, maybe we see it did happen before.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, speaking about the low frequency events, I mean, the things that are really bad, but don't happen very often. You know, that's one thing I think we've, as a professional community, been struggling with for a long time is how we communicate that risk. You know, and for a long time, we always talked about the 100-year flood event. And for many years, you know, all of our regulatory flood maps had that listed on it. It's like, if you were in this zone and it was shaded, then you were in the 100-year floodplain. And I think over time, we realized that the community, the public at large, just generally doesn't understand what that means. So there was a fundamental misunderstanding of the fact that the 100-year flood event could happen, you know, in back-to-back years. You know, they think, oh, it will never happen in my lifetime. So then, you know, we changed to talking about this risk in terms of exceedance probabilities. So we said, oh, well, people don't understand what the 100-year, you know, return period storm event is. So we're going to say, well, it's a 1% chance in any given year that this could happen. And for a lot of the public, that still doesn't really move the needle on getting them worried about something bad happening. Say, oh, there's only a 1% chance. That's basically next to nothing. I'm not going to worry about it. So putting that in a little bit more context of time, then is the next step where we've really failed to communicate risk to the public and say, well, hey, let's think about this in terms of if you're taking out a mortgage on the house that you just bought in the floodplain and you've got to pay the bank back for the next 30 years. Well, then that 1% exceedance probability event or that 100-year return period event, it's got a very high likelihood of happening over that 30-year period. And so, you know, how much risk are you willing to accept? And, you know, for these events that are really extreme but don't happen very often, again, no matter how we communicate it, couch it in terms of a phrase or jargon, it really comes down to showing them an example of when and where it's happened in their area so that they have that context that this has happened here. It can happen again. So it makes them a little bit more aware of what their exposure really is.
Well, Brett, all great points. I mean, like you said, that 1% chance of flooding annually, I think in a 30-year mortgage, it comes out to 26, 27%. But I always tell people that's just if you're on the edge of the floodplain, right on the edge. What if you're in the middle of the floodplain? Your property might flood on average every 40 years. All of a sudden, then you have, an 80, 90% chance of flooding in a 30-year mortgage. It's probable that you're going to have flood water. And I think, like you said, you shift the time frame and start talking about a 30-year mortgage. Suddenly people say, wait, it's probable. I'm going to flood. I don't know if I want to buy this property.
Yeah. If somebody was telling me that there was there's basically a 1 in 4 chance that I could experience this really extreme weather event, I would be less inclined to live there and invest in that type of real estate or that type of property. So we still, again, as a community of professionals, I know everyone's doing their best and we're always finding new ways to improve our science communication. But, you know, lately the big thing that, you know, has been maybe moving the needle a little bit on this is kind of this convergent research, convergent science, where we're bringing social scientists into the conversation more and more about the messaging and about the mapping and about how we communicate that risk to the public.
No, I think that's so important because even if we get the physical science right, if we're not communicating it accurately, we've missed our audience, right?
Absolutely. And as an engineer, I'm really not the person that should be figuring out the best ways to communicate information to the public. You know, that really is within the realm of the social scientist. One thing I believe in very strongly as a practicing engineer outside of the research that I do through the, you know, academia, is, you know, staying in your lane, understanding your role, and only basically practicing in the areas of your competence. And, you know, communicating to the public is not an area in which I've ever been trained. So understanding people's roles and their value and putting them in the right position to do their work is extremely important. And you know, communicating hurricane risk is no different. We need to rely on those professionals to do their jobs.
Yeah, Brett, thanks so much for that insight. Kind of what you're saying, we have different professionals in different roles that can fit these capacities kind of working together as a team or as a community. Brett, you know, with your decades of experience as a coastal engineer, you're able to provide us with a bird's eye view kind of, and I think our listeners are really going to enjoy this. As you look at the state of the art of disaster, as disaster science, kind of looking at the bird's eye picture, how have we progressed, say, in the past 5 to 10 years? I mean, what are some of these technological innovations or just different ways we're approaching things over the past decade?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. You know, first and foremost, you know, for the benefit of the listeners, I'm not a meteorologist, so I don't do hurricane forecasting. I do get involved in, you know, trying to do prediction of hurricane storm surge and waves. But I'm not a hurricane forecaster. But what I know about the hurricane forecasts, especially over the past 5 to 10 years, is that their accuracy and reliability has increased substantially and in remarkable ways. So thinking about how accurate our forecasts now are 3 and even 5 days out in some cases is just a phenomenal shift from where we were a decade ago. And they were already doing a very good job a decade ago. So the fact that we have, you know, I will go back and reference Hurricane Ian as a most recent example of an extreme hurricane, you know, that has impacted our coast. You know, from 5 days out, their forecasted landfall position did not vary along the coast by very much. And in fact, the landfall position that actually occurred was in every single advisory forecast since they started issuing advisory forecasts. So they did a phenomenal job actually forecasting that event. So that the forecasts have improved and are improving all the time. One of the things that has changed a lot in the past 5 to 10 years that maybe we're not doing as good of a job forecasting is this thing called rapid intensification. And you know, to kind of break that term down into something a little bit more simple, without using specific numbers, it's, you know, the hurricane, basically the wind speeds increase by a set amount in a 24-hour period. And we've seen that happen in almost every single major landfalling hurricane in the past 5 or 6 years, actually going all the way back to Hurricane Michael in 2018 that impacted the Port St. Joe and Mexico Beach area. So this rapid increase in wind speed prior to landfall is still something that the forecasts are not able to pick up yet. So that'll be an area of focus and improvement in the future. And a lot of this has been being driven by kind of local pockets of really warm water in the Gulf or the Atlantic over these, you know, these areas where the hurricanes are moving. And a lot of it also has to do with just more moisture and warmer temperatures in the atmosphere that allow this hurricane to kind of spin up pretty rapidly prior to landfall. And in some cases, this is causing the hurricane to kind of jump from one category to the next right before impact. So it's, you know, there's still room for improvement, but man, the forecasts are so much better than they used to be. The other thing that's happening now that didn't really happen before 10 years ago was all this new convergent science and research related to data collection during and after hurricanes. You know, for the United States has a fairly long history, you know, going back to maybe the late 1970s when federal agencies like FEMA and the Army Corps of Engineers started dispatching teams of professionals after hurricane events to survey high water marks, which have been an invaluable source of data for researchers like me who are trying to kind of validate, you know, hurricane storm surge models to make sure we get the flooding right. And of course, this goes into all aspects of, you know, risk communication and flood prediction, like flood maps and all sorts of things. But that was pretty much it. I mean, if we had maybe an operational tide gauge or tide station along the coast that survived the event, we might have some information, and then we have the high water marks after the fact. But we had very few observations of things that were happening during the event and almost no data collection of what we would call the perishable data immediately following the event. Like, what was damaged? How much was it damaged? Where did the damage occur? Where did the debris go, you know, during the event? And so, you know, really kind of starting back maybe with Hurricane Ivan in 2004, this started to become formalized in a little bit more. There was a little bit more structure to these post-event reconnaissance missions, but they were primarily, you know, just structural surveys. Now, over the past decade, we've got entire teams of university researchers and federal agencies that are actually heading to the coast before a hurricane to deploy sensors that are going to continuously measure things like storm surge and waves and winds and pressures and temperatures and humidities and all these different things that allow us to then improve our knowledge of hurricanes and our ability to forecast them. So this idea now of rushing to the coast to collect this sensitive data that's very valuable at multiple locations throughout the forecasted, the area of impact is really led to some really interesting advancements in our understanding of not only hurricanes themselves, but hurricane storm surge and waves. This is everything from, you know, deploying, you know, say like rapidly deployable tide gauges and wave gauges along the coast to mobile towers that are set up on land that are going to measure the profile of the wind all the way from the ground surface up to maybe like 30 or 40 feet above the ground. But now we have funding from agencies like the National Science Foundation and a coordinating framework that provides opportunities for researchers like me to rush into these areas and collect this data before, during, and after the event, to the point where we've got teams of people that exist within this kind of ecosystem called Converge, which they're all different aspects of what we call extreme events reconnaissance groups. And so there's a structural engineering extreme events reconnaissance group called STEER. There's a coastal one called the Nearshore Extreme Events Reconnaissance Group called NEAR. There's one for geotechnical engineering to look at foundation collapses or scour or erosion, things like that, called GEAR. And there's one for social science, and the list goes on and on. But what's great now about kind of state-of-the-art hurricane research and science is that this is all coordinated in real time when there's a forecasted event. So we've got teams of people that are directing us to the area that is most likely to be impacted. And once we get all those teams on the ground, there's real-time active coordination and collaboration of moving people and assets around to get them deployed and instruments in the right places to coordinate all this activity. And then after the fact, all these people come back together and synthesize all the information. So we are really living in kind of the golden age of data and information. And I really can't wait to see what happens in the next decade, with all of this new information that we have and have been collecting.
Well, Brett, you're right. You know, during a storm system, you see all these different research groups coming out with data from coastal flooding and coastal winds. And you compare that to what we saw, say, in the 80s and 90s. You'd have a hurricane make landfall, and you'd get maybe 20 high water marks. Now we get hundreds, right? And a lot of those we can see in the National Hurricane Center report. They might be from a university. They might be from FEMA, USGS, all these different groups working together to not only get out there and take high water marks in buildings, but also deploy mobile sensors, all this type of coordinated effort, like you said, with research teams going down there. I always think, you know, if we can get people doing field work, that helps validate the modeling. It helps improve the modeling moving forward, right?
Absolutely. And we actually have an exciting new project with the University of Florida for the next few hurricane seasons. It's funded by the U.S. Coastal Research Program through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Engineer Research and Development Center. And the University of Florida, for maybe a little bit around three decades, I think at least, have had this program called the Florida Coastal Monitoring Program, where they have these mobile towers that they go set up kind of what they believe to be in the path of the hurricane, but in the upland, to kind of measure that lower profile of wind speeds, you know, right near the ground, the really important part of the atmosphere that we need for a lot of structural design. Well, we partner with them now in a program called Shorelines, which is essentially basically an operational and logistics network for organizing people to deploy instruments along the coast. And they're developing a new version of their monitoring tower that we will deploy directly on the beach at intervals along the coast to capture the impacts of landfalling hurricane. So these are called Sentinel Towers. They're purpose built and designed to withstand the forces of the hurricane. And again, will be deployed right on the beach to measure water levels and waves and erosion and wind speed and all these things in a place and in a way that we've really never been able to measure before. And this information is going to be shared in real time with NOAA and National Hurricane Center and news media outlets and other private weather service providers that'll feed into their weather service monitoring and alerts. So we're really excited about that project because, again, we're trying to move the needle on data collection and our understanding to kind of advance the state of the science on hurricane research. But thinking back to our earlier conversation about communicating risk, one new thing that we're trying to do with these towers is measure water quality in fluxes or the amounts of, maybe contaminants and other pathogens that might be moving in and out of these systems as these hurricanes make landfall and then, move past us and the floodwaters recede. So thinking back to that earlier conversation about communicating risk and hazards, I think one of the things that, we often fail to communicate is the risk after the event of people hurting themselves. And, of course, we probably have heard the sad stories of people hurting themselves, falling out of trees or falling off of roofs, doing repairs. But after Hurricane Ian, about half of the deaths that occurred that are attributed to Hurricane Ian in Florida were actually after the event and were related to exposure to pathogens in the floodwaters. And that's actually a magnitude of human death that we have not seen attributed to bacterial problems after an event, just due to all of the pollutants and pathogens that were in the floodwaters. So, what we're trying to do with this new project and is maybe add some capacity to, these Sentinel towers that will deploy along the coast to measure these fluxes of, these in water quality parameters before, during, and after these events to maybe get to a point where we can better communicate those risks to the public.
Yeah, Brett, I'm glad you mentioned about people getting these, seriously injured or even fatalities from the floodwater after the storm. A lot of people think the day of the storm is your big risk. And then once it's passed, your danger has passed. People walking through floodwaters, especially with an open cut, an open wound, a break in the skin, all kinds of contaminants can enter. And it sounds like you're saying they can really be fatal. And this might be something that really blindsides a lot of people, right?
Yeah, I think it really is. And if you're thinking about the context of what you're likely to come in contact, it's if you just live through the hurricane and are cleaning up after, you probably have tons of scratches and cuts all over you. So, having those and then getting into floodwaters after the fact, I know we're never going to be able to prevent people from wanting to clean up immediately after the event. But we really have to do a better job of identifying what the water quality conditions are after these events and really making a strong case to keep people out of the floodwater for just as long as possible. We're making sure that if they do have to go into the floodwaters, to make sure that they're taking the proper precautions before and after to make sure that they're seeking treatment as quickly as possible to manage any potential infection or health risk.
Brett, thanks for giving us that oversight. I think that's really going to help people stay safer in storm events before, during, and after. Well, hey, we have a couple minutes left on the podcast as we wrap up. What are a few bullet points of what people can expect moving forward and how we can prepare for this future of coastal hazards?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, the future, obviously, if I had a crystal ball, I'd look into it and tell you exactly what was going to happen. And I don't think any of us truly know that, but the science tends to be converging, on a fairly, I would say, uniform outlook of what we might have coming ahead in terms of hurricane hazards. Obviously, number one, we've spent a lot of time in this episode talking about risk, and our risk along the coast is already high. And we've actually done quite a bit of research over the years to look at how that risk might change under future sea level rise. And, the answer is the risk is definitely going to change, but incrementally. Our risk along the coast is already so high that when we add a little bit of sea level rise to that, it just makes a bad thing, look a little bit worse. the place where we're really likely to see more of an issue are in like the nuisance flooding events, the flooding events that happen very often and that are annoying and may actually cause monetary damage and may in some ways pose a health risk. But this kind of persistent new inundation, say a high tide due to sea level rise, or maybe a high tide and sea level rise combined with a strong rainfall event, are going to lead to flooding events that are minor in nature, but you know, magnitude, so to speak, but happen a lot more often. So this could impact your ability to get to work. It could damage your vehicle. It could damage things on your property, things of that nature. One of the things that is very true about, you know, looking into the crystal ball and thinking about our risk moving forward, and thinking about the things that we've covered in this episode, borrowing a quote from George Box, who said, all models are wrong, but some are useful. I think we have to adopt a similar, you know, line of thought for our flood maps. You know, all flood maps are wrong the day that they go from preliminary to effective, but some are useful. And fundamentally, they're wrong at the time they're adopted because they don't account for things like future sea level rise or future change in storm intensity. And every single time we have a new comprehensive assessment of future climate, the picture ahead is becoming more and more clear that we are more likely to experience stronger, more extreme, more frequent events moving into the future. So the number of major landfalling hurricane events, especially in the Gulf and Atlantic basins, is forecasted to increase over time in a warmer future climate with warmer, you know, sea surface temperatures. That combined with long-term sea level rise is going to expand those floodplains over time, and it's going to capture new areas that, you know, in the past haven't seen coastal impacts. You know, that there are a lot of areas in the United States that flood even away from the coast, you know, due to rainfall runoff events. And floodwaters are bad and they do cause damage. But along the coast, if you have exposure to direct wave action, it can really cause significant structural damage. And it really only takes about an 18 to 24 inch tall wave to damage a typical light frame residential structure. And they can do quite a bit of damage for vehicles as well. So thinking ahead to things that might happen, it's, you know, if you're already living in a floodplain today, especially along the coast, you know, your exposure and your risk is going to go up in the future.
Brett, thank you so much for sharing it. Yeah, just really appreciate you sharing these perspectives with us today. You're bringing in decades of knowledge and experience doing coastal engineering. And I'm really glad on this podcast we're able to talk about kind of an overview of the state of the science today, but also where we're going in the future. Brett, I know you're going to be working. Hopefully, we don't have any major landfalling hurricanes along the Gulf and the Atlantic this year. But if we do, I think a lot of folks are going to be better prepared because of the work that you and your team are doing. How can people find you? If people want to say, who is this Brett Webb guy? Who is Dr. Webb? How can I find his publications and his work? How can they find you online?
You know, I'm pretty easy to find on LinkedIn. The only thing that might trip people up is my first name is spelled with one T. We'll thank my parents for that. It's actually an acronym, but they couldn't find a second T anywhere in the family. So it's all family names that make up my name, but I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. And if you go to the University of South Alabama and search for my name, you'll find my faculty webpage. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter, and I'm a regular poster there.
Dr. Webb, thank you so much for taking time to join us on the podcast, hoping for a safe hurricane season. And I know you'll be involved in watching what happens, not only with hurricanes, but I know you're involved with sea level rise, coastal infrastructure, and everything that that takes place along our coast. Appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Brett, thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast and sharing your profound insights with us. Three things really stood out to me in our conversation. Number one, you reminded us of the challenges we face to help people understand their flood risk. As you mentioned, 60% of people who live in floodplains do not even realize they're there, and it's always a challenge to communicate flood risk to people statistically. You brought up the challenges of communicating that someone is in the 100-year floodplain, which means they have a 1% chance of flooding annually if they live right on the edge of that area. Both 100-year flood and 1% chance of flooding annually sound really infrequent to people, and I like the concept you had about framing flood risk in terms of inundation likeliness over a 30-year mortgage, which is actually 26% chance of happening if you're right on the edge of the 100-year floodplain, and even a greater chance if you're more in the middle of that floodplain. Number two, you reminded us that indirect deaths are often surprisingly high following hurricanes. While direct storm deaths come from occurrences like drowning or being struck by wind-borne debris, indirect deaths include dozens of possible occurrences that can happen in the days after a big storm. You mentioned the high number of fatalities from pathogens in the floodwater following Hurricane Ian in 2022, which is a good reminder that we need to stay out of floodwater, especially if we have a cut or open sore on our bodies. Number three, I loved your perspective that we are now in the golden age of data and information science. The explosion of big data in the science community has opened up so many opportunities for young professionals to make a big impact in saving lives and property from disasters. Keep in mind that these opportunities come from a wide range of a variety of fields, including engineering, meteorology, oceanography, data science, and a wide range of social sciences like communication, sociology, and psychology. My home discipline of geography provides a useful blend of physical and social science to help solve disaster problems through digital mapping. So I'm really glad you brought that up. We have a lot of young professionals and students that listen to the podcast. We always want to help point them in directions of some opportunities that they could follow professionally in their careers. I'm hoping that hurricane impacts in the Atlantic Basin this season stay to a minimum, but when storms do strike, these perspectives from Dr. Webb will help us all stay more resilient. Hey, speaking of storms in the Atlantic, we already had one hurricane strike on Texas this season from Hurricane Beryl in early July. This historic hurricane inflicted surprising impacts on the Houston-Galveston corridor with plenty of lessons learned on the ground. Don't miss out on very special GeoTrek podcast episode number 100, Historic Hurricane Beryl, Pay It Forward from Texas, which will air on Tuesday, July 30th. Until then, try to get outside and enjoy this beautiful summer weather, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.